Off the ball. Rugby.
Then all we'll never know until we play. We know on the evidence of play well for your province, play well in Europe, play well in the URC, consistently back it up for a couple, four, five, six matches. And then people go, give him a go.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah?
Yeah. I believe in my county, and I suppose they're good at football. They just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12. I love playing 10. I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
No!
Thank you for all the supporters. Thank you for the team. Thank you, France. Merci la France. Merci les baguettes. Merci les croissants. Je vous aime. I love you.
Hello, 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 and welcome to Word on the Street, where every week we take a trending sporting topic, something dominating the headlines, and we take it to the public, or, in this instance, a professional.
Mm.
Eve, how are you?
I'm very good. I'm excited. We have a professional taking it into the studio with us today.
Yeah, you may have noticed as well that I have taken the hot seat. I've usurped Susanna.
Yeah, there's been a coup,
and now
Rachel's in charge.
No, Susanna, as ever, is busy with rugby. Six Nations fever is upon us. So
Sixmas, I'd never heard of that before, but then I've heard people calling it Sixmas, and I'm not sure that I like that. Your eyes have gone very wide and panicked for the podcast listeners.
I never want to hear that again.
Yes, okay, I'm sorry.
But yes, we have a very exciting guest coming into us today, professional offshore sailor Pamela Lee.
This is something that I love when this happens, where it's a sport I really do not know much about, but I kind of have a vague context for sailing as a whole, but then offshore sailing, it's like, okay, I really actually don't know anything. Here's a chance to get it explained sort of from an expert, from a professional.
Yeah, because I would be the same. Like, knowledge of sailing comes from watching it for 15 minutes at the Olympics maybe every year.
Yeah.
It's all I know.
Exactly.
You know, so offshore sailing is a completely different beast, really male-dominated, mm-hmm. and Pamela is going to tell us all about how she got into it in the first place and a very exciting race that she's undertaking in 2026. So let's cut the shit. Let's hear from Pamela right now. Oh, we are delighted to be joined here by Pamela Lee, with myself and Eve. Susanna MIA today. She's covering the Six Nations with the rugby. But Pamela, you're just over from France. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Funny you mentioned the rugby, actually. I was at the match there on Thursday. The French were very nice.
Did you change codes? Did you start shouting for France at halftime?
No. I think it's like probably the one tricky subject with my boyfriend, who is French. Like, we can't talk rugby. But it was good, actually. My elder brother and his wife were over, so we did have Irish in the gang. But
yeah, probably a Thursday night to forget in Paris.
Yeah, sure. If we're gonna lose to anyone, might as well be France.
Exactly. But we are not here to talk rugby.
No.
We're here to talk sailing. And I suppose, first of all, myself and Eve were chatting off air. Our perceptions of sailing are what you might see in the Olympics, maybe for kind of 15, 20 minutes every 4 years, the small lasers. But you are a professional offshore sailor. Can you tell us a bit about the difference?
Yeah, it's very different. And it's cool. It's actually cool that you mentioned that, because one of the things that I like to do or try to do or see as a little bit of my mini mission is to try and change the perception of what maybe sailing is and open it up, because it can be many, many, many things. And I think particularly in Ireland, we might have a bit of a closed vision to that, and sometimes it seems like a little less accessible. But actually, I think it's a sport, along with a lot of water sports, that have a lot to offer. And I like talking about it, because I like opening it up and saying, well, actually, maybe it's something someone else could try, or bring something else to somebody that maybe field sports or athletics doesn't quite fit the bill. But offshore sailing is, yeah, so as you mentioned, we have the Olympics, and we have some amazing Irish sailors, Annalise Murphy and Eve, who've done class things, the women, which is always cool.
Getting that in early, yeah.
So I guess I try to always think of comparison. So what they do is short races, several races a day usually, but ultimately they leave the dock in the morning, do a number of short races, and come home, go to bed in the evening and do it again. Kind of like a lot of classical sports that we would know. Maybe you could kind of put it in with tennis or something like that. Whereas what I do is offshore sailing. So we are going to sea. and that can be anything from like 24 hours to 48 hours. which would be really short for me, to like 5 or 6 days, which could probably be my like classical length, to ultimately transatlantic races, which is like 15 to 20 days on the boats that I'm racing in. And then, you know, the big apple, the big Everest is the around the world race, which is kind of what you, well, a lot of offshore sailors or, you know, you'd work towards. The other side of it that's quite different is, well, in that sense, because we're going to see what we're dealing with is very different. Inshore sailors, they're very focused on exactly what's happening in their playing field, on their pitch, so to speak, which is like the small area that they're sailing with in. And there's going to be effects there, the wind that's coming that day, how that wind is affected by the local land and that kind of thing. But it's very in that phase of their match, kind of like rugby or anything else, like you've got the game time.
Yeah.
Whereas what we're dealing with is like you're looking at the weather systems that are coming at you across the sea, across the ocean, across a number of days, and how you're going to approach and attack those weather systems. So the level of meteorology and oceanography kind of jumps to a new phase there. So it really brings that element in.
Yeah.
And the other side of it is the boats that we're racing are bigger, faster, more technical.
How big are we talking? Lighter.
So what I'm sailing, there's a lot of different classes. So it all depends. What I'm sailing is class 40, and that's a 40-foot boat, so 12 meters.
Oh.
Yeah.
On your own.
Yeah, so what I'm focusing on, again, there's a few different categories, but where I'm really focused is short-handed offshore sailing. So that's one sailor, sometimes two. Our max team is four. So, but this year, again, there's different cycles, and what I've been really focusing on is working towards doing the solo. So obviously it takes a bit of time to get to that level, and you build it up, and also to have the opportunity to have a boat, to be able to race and have the opportunity to go solo takes a lot of work even to get there, because as I said, this is like a racing machine. So the other comparison I use often is kind of Formula One, because you have this like high speed tech like machine, like it's cool, made for going fast, but also made for kind of hammering through the ocean.
I wanted to mention the kind of Formula One comparison, because you kind of said it yourself in some of your press releases and everything, and you described it as kind of a combination of Formula One and endurance racing, which I thought was so accurate. But it's almost as well like you need to be the driver and your race engineer. You have to have this knowledge, as you were saying, of stuff like oceanology, of stuff like meteorology. Trying to kind of balance that, is it something where it's like a very steep learning curve once you turn professional, or is it something that you're honing over many years?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's one of the reasons why I think I find this boat so fascinating. There's so many different aspects, like you're never done. And what's interesting about the sport as well, because of that, I think, and because of this huge knowledge base that you need to learn and build up, you can only build that up, like even if you have a steep learning curve at certain moments, it is only time and experience. And how do you get the experience? From being on the water and racing. And how do you do that? Over time. You can't fast forward it. So you can study, and you know, you can do intensive years where you're doing a lot of time on the water and you're doing a lot of racing. You can, a lot of the way that we learn as well is from sailing with other sailors. So trying to get onto teams where you're sailing with sailors who have more experience than you or have seen things you haven't done. And so, yeah, it really is something that you build up over time. And there is, we do have training camps. It's much more established in France, and they kind of do funnel theirs. In France, they kind of have a program where some of their sailors are funneled through this kind of intensive training camps over years. But ultimately, it is kind of time on the water and accumulation of knowledge from experience that builds it up. And that's kind of an incredible thing about the sport is there's two things about offshore sailing. There's no male-female category. So it's the first sailor across the line wins. And there's no age category. And you know, there isn't really an age where you sign out. I can be racing against guys in their, I mean, as long as they're fit enough, like in their 70s, and they can be really, really, really good because they've seen it. Like they've seen so much of it before. They've got all this experience and they can kind of, I mean, you've never seen any situation twice. It doesn't happen like that on the sea, but you can apply that knowledge. And so there's a really interesting aspect to the sport in that sense where you're really kind of, there's a lot of respect for kind of your elders and respect for others and learning from others. And again, that kind of respect for nature and trying to be humble because you're trying to learn each time. And also there's this kind of in like in France, and it's growing more worldwide. But there's an industry around it, like Formula One, where, you know, you have engineers, electricians, strategists, meteorologists, communications around the boat and around the team who are working on all these aspects. And as the skipper, ultimately, I need to have a bit of all of this. I don't need to be an expert in mechanics, but I need to know enough to be able to figure out and understand my boat. I don't need to be an expert in electronics, but I need to kind of have an expert that I know that I can ask questions to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it builds up around that. So it's quite interesting. And that's why I think it kind of falls into that Formula One kind of vibe where there is actually really cool career paths and stuff all built all around it and built around sport.
Is it kind of frustrating sometimes in that you need a lot of money to succeed? No matter how skillful you are, no matter how much experience you are, you need the money to have those kind of teams around you and to have the best boat that you can have.
Yeah, like ultimately that's one of the, you know, I think it's a pro and a con to the sport. And I think, yeah, it absolutely is. And you say the kind of different hats that you have to wear as a sailor, you know, that there's the sailing bit, there's the being an athlete, there's the meteorology, the engineering and all of these aspects, as well as the tactics and the navigation. There's also the side of having a kind of commercial hat. And it's really, I was thinking about it today, actually, and, you know, it's really stepping into that side of commercializing a sport and how can we commercialize it. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's actually a really good thing. Like, you hear artists talk about it and you hear musicians talk about it. And, like, does the art lose its art if it's commercialized? And I don't think it is at all. And I think understanding how to commercialize a sport outside of kind of the standard tickets, a logo on a jersey and a logo in a stadium on the kind of classic sports that we think everyone follows is a really interesting area. And that's kind of what we're really working with because it's sponsorship. Like, we're really dealing with sponsorship and you're thinking, okay, I need a sponsor to have the boat to get to race to do what I want to do. But what am I giving that sponsor? So you're really thinking about what you can do with the sport, what you can do with this boat. Like, what can sport deliver emotionally, engaging people and stuff? And you really start to explore that side of it. And I think there's something there that we can learn for a lot of sports and can kind of help to commercialize different sports. Like, I think you've seen surfing do it really well. You know, it's become very cool, kind of very sexy and all of that. Whereas originally it probably wasn't a commercialized sport at all. You kind of see it with kite surfing and stuff like that. Like sports that classically you'd say are a little bit niche, but are really stepping into their own. And it's kind of a bit like that with sailing. So in one sense, yeah, it is really tricky because you have to have this other hat. And I call it like I have my kind of skipper athlete side where like all I want to do is train and go sailing and get better and try to win and perform, you know. But on the other side, I have, I used to call it my CEO hat, but now I've thought about it a bit more and it's actually like my entrepreneur hat where I have to think of like, how do I make this maintainable for myself? And I think even athletes have to think about that now as well, because particularly in Ireland, like it's a small country. There's not loads of funding and like government funding going around. So how are you going to do the sport that you want to do or make a career out of it? And you've got to think of other ways to do it. And so
it's self-branding, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And creating a concept around it. I mean, my current project is called Hashtag Empower. So it's not Pamela Lee. Sailor, you know, I thought about it a lot and I looked at how other teams did it and I have a background in communications and art, so I think I've got like a little bit of the creative hat. And also I understand that as the athlete and the sailor, I kind of need to be the profile and I take the role of being a role model or that like very seriously, but I don't necessarily just want to go around tooting my own horn and waving my own flag, you know. It's also really hard to do. And then it comes back to that, like, how can you add value to the sponsors? And so we created like this concept around the project, and the project is a 2-year project which ultimately ends in a big race at the end of this year, which is the Route de Rome, a solo transatlantic once every 4 years. So it's kind of like our Olympics, like the opportunity to get to do it, let alone finish it, is a huge thing. And I will be the first Irish sailor to do it as well. So it is really big. But what what can I deliver to sponsors for? How can I get them on board? And I realized like the key topics that I'm in a position to talk about or communicate about are clearly gender equality and women's sport, but women in the world. And I think we'll all agree that women's sport, even like looking at the Olympics and everything like that, like the absolute power that it has. And I really believe that talking about sport, communicating about women's sport is going to have a huge impact on how we progress in society and maintain that going forward. We can list off all the stats that we know about girls in sport and how that affects their careers and the dropout rates and how can we change it. So that's obviously a huge topic that I have. I feel like I have a right and an obligation to talk about, but it's also something that sponsors and companies are really interested in. So that's the her and the empower. And the other area that's really important is sustainability and green energy. And we're talking about sailing boats, you know, we're talking about nature. So I do have a grounds to be able to speak about that and communicate that as well. And that comes into the power section. So for the sponsors that are, they come in under this umbrella of Empower, which ultimately, you know, I'm there and I'm there to work with them and be the spokesperson. But it's a group of sponsors who are engaged and want to speak about gender equality and green energy. And we use the boat and offshore sailing as our avenue to do it.
It's interesting. I saw you'd mentioned in an article before that you'd never even thought that a career as a sailor would be possible. It was almost something like you'd say, I want to be an astronaut. And like, I'd love to do that, but it's not a realistic avenue. But now you're creating that for girls growing up.
Yeah, like 100%. I would go as far as say I never would have even, like, I played sport my whole life. Like, it's always been there. I played a lot of hockey. I'm really lucky that sailing and water sports in general has been a part of my life, and it's just because my dad's obsessed. You know, we've got all sorts of stories, but you know, my granddad, and then my dad was obsessed, and he's got stories about kind of this boat that he bought for a shilling and used like the sheets of his dad's laundry business to build the sails, or none of it's verified, but
but it's a great story.
Yeah, but you know, and he's still sailing now every Wednesday and Saturday, like he's a total addict. And so our family time was like obligation in boats and around, so there was no option. So it was just part of my life, which is really cool. And then also playing hockey and a lot of other sports, but I never considered, I think, as a girl growing up in Ireland, I never, playing high level sport, I never considered that it could actually be a career. I would have thought if you wanted a career in sport, you needed to be a physio. That was the route.
100%. Yeah, yeah. I'll go off and study sports science and maybe get the master's in physiotherapy after. Yeah. That's the only avenue in.
And I really considered that.
Yeah.
And then I was like,
or
but
a
no.
PE teacher, maybe.
Yeah, that would be another good option, solid option.
Yeah. or a sports journalist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy.
And that was the other thing. There was a time when I was really into water sports photography because it's in that route. And, you know, I did travel around and my brother is kitesurf and stuff as well. So we're kind of all in that vibe. And it helps when there's people around you doing it because it gives you access and you bounce off. But like, I'd say my older brother was loving it because I used to just always be there with the camera taking cool photos. And I think about it and it's like, actually, I love the photography side of it and that creative side. But I think it was because I when you think about being a surf photographer, for instance, I was like, it's because I envied those who were in the position to actually do the sport. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And I think if I was a sport physio, it would have been because I envied the athletes that were the sport. And so I didn't go down those routes because I think inside I knew it would have killed me a little bit.
Yeah. Was there a point where you realised then, okay, this is possible?
Well, it came really slowly through a few experiences. You know, I had where my eyes got a little bit opened to the opportunities and industry of the sport outside of Ireland. And I think the biggest turning point was I ended up living in Australia, in Sydney for a few years because my brother was there and I'd finished my studies, so I ended up. And they have a lot of offshore sailing there, but it's like teamed, so there's kind of 10 or 15 people on a boat. And it's a little bit different in that generally it's like a private sport. So there's usually an owner or someone who owns the boat and then he brings the team together. So I was doing a lot of that at an amateur level. but like a high level amateur level. And I started to see these kind of professional boats around. And I was like, oh, there's some people who are doing, who are getting paid to do that. Still in the situation where essentially you're getting paid by a private individual. But still, I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. And so little by little, you know, I started to see that there was a thing, you know. And then I kind of had a few different turning points where I was kind of wrapping up in Australia, trying to decide whether to stay, what to do, change kind of in my careers and different stuff. And from talking to people and so on, I understood that there was kind of this sailing industry between the Caribbean and the Mediterranean. I was like, okay, well, maybe I can kind of get some qualifications, get my yacht master qualification, which qualifies you to steer, like drive boats at sea, essentially. And I can go and try that out and just do it as work and travel for a few years, because I wanted to travel, but I didn't have money. So I started doing that between Caribbean and the Mediterranean, kind of doing these seasons. But like, I just had this hunger, that competitive side coming out. I just had this hunger to race. I wanted to race, and I wanted to race more. And I was getting to race, but it was, again, on these teams of kind of up to 15 people on a boat, and always by a private owner. So it's kind of like the owner decides what's going on, and I was pretty much always the only girl on board. And so then I ultimately had, like, because there's 15 people, you have very, very clean positions, like in rugby. You know, you have your position, that's your job. But after a while, I kind of started to find that, like, a bit repetitive and a bit boring. Like, I really wanted to be navigating or doing the tactics or driving. And it became quite clear I was never going to get the opportunity to do that. So I got a bit disillusioned.
Do you think that was because there was just kind of too many people on a boat, or do you think that was because you were trying that, even though it's a gender neutral sport in that way, it's perhaps not a gender equal sport, and that you were fighting against what I'm imagining is still a very male dominated sport?
Yeah, I think I think it's the two factors, you know what I mean? But and again, as I said, it's a sport where you need experience to get good, to be able to do the position. But if you don't get the experience, how do you get good and how do you get the position? And I think that's a bit of a like cyclical question that we have, like, even in society. Yeah. You know, that's like a bigger question. And it was playing out exactly in this little ecosystem of a boat. I could just see it. Well, how am I going to get a chance to do it if I never get a chance to do it? And yeah, it is like the lads. And they're all working there to get their job, so, you know, they want to keep their position because ultimately they're getting paid for it as well, you know what I mean? And they're not going to hand it over, and kind of who's boss, but then ultimately how are you going to get the experience? And so it's kind of just like a vicious cycle, and you're like, well, how am I going to break through to open that door? Exactly. And so I stopped, and it was a little bit of a weird phase. And I was back in Ireland, like in COVID, and there was like a certain point where I was like, I wasn't living with my parents, because, you know, at the start of COVID, we were like, no, don't go near elder people, you'll kill them. So I couldn't stay with my parents, because before I'd been in Australia, so I was a bit like homeless. So I was staying with my younger brother and his wife, and I didn't have a job because I just finished the sailing, and it was COVID. So then I was working in my older brother's factory as like a welder. I was like, life has taken a dark turn. This is not how I envisaged it. And then kind of out of nowhere, I got this opportunity to go to France, because there became a topic that maybe for the Paris Olympics 2024 that we just had, they were maybe going to bring in a discipline of offshore sailing, which would be double-handed, two people, and had to be mixed. So in the end, they didn't. They put in kite surfing, which is cool as well, you know, no problem. But it brought it onto the table, and there was kind of a push to try and get an Irish team. Oh, yeah, we could, you know, we could try and qualify and go to the Olympics. Like, amazing. That hadn't been like an option for us before, unless you were down the very specific laser tunnel, you know, like very specific. So I got the opportunity to go to France, because France is the place for double-handed and short-handed offshore racing, like that specific thing. So we came to France to start to train. And I got to France, and I saw that the way the industry works there, as a professional industry, it's not individuals who own boats who pick their favourites to be on the team. It's a professional sport, you know. So of course,
funded by sponsorship.
The,
okay.
Yeah. Well, there is there's government funding at certain levels in France as well.
Yeah.
Like with all their sports, they just have a bigger sports environment there. So, and that applies also to sailing and offshore sailing. But also the sponsorship model is really well established. So there's even sponsors that sponsor like academies, you know. So you can, as a French person, I wasn't eligible, but as a French person who has maybe been through the government programs to a certain point and been sailing, you can then apply for these kind of intensive 3-year training programs where you're given a boat and you're given this, and that's funded by like banks, CMB, Banque Populaire, like they're invested in investing in that, and it kind of all goes around. So that ecosystem of professionalizing the sport is there, and it kind of, it works well because the sponsors are embedded in it. They understand the value that's offered, and the sailors go around. And seeing that, I was like, okay, there's a lot more women, still not as many as men. There's a lot more women, but also there's more of a feeling that A, if you're good and you work hard, you could actually carve your way through, because it's not just based on whether someone, obviously people need to like you or not, but it's not just based on that. Like you, there's teams, you need to get on a team and prove yourself, you know, and you can build your way up.
The avenue does exist.
Exactly. And the other side of it being, hold on, there is this, and that came a bit more slowly, I think, realizing that actually if there's this commercial side to it, maybe there's a position to create your own pathway as well. And I started doing that. So I was kind of, at one stage, building my skills and my career by sailing and working for other teams. So kind of being a freelance sailor. And at the same time, kind of developing my concept and building those skills to be able to hopefully apply to my own project to ultimately then be the skipper, you know,
yeah.
Which is kind of the ultimate. And that's when you're in the position to really learn and really excel. So whether I'm a skipper of my own project for the rest of my career, or whether I go back at certain points to sail with other sailors, the skills that I've learned as a sailor from running my own boat, running my own project and doing my own way is going to make me a better athlete sailor ultimately. So yeah, it just opened up a different way of seeing how one could be professional in sport.
So this November is the route to, am I pronouncing that right? The route to room?
So it's called the route to rum, like rum that you drink.
Nice. All very on brand.
So they have, because they have the Transat Café Loire, which is actually the, they changed the name and I've totally, Transat Café Loire. It used to be the Transat Jacques Vabre, and that's a coffee brand. So that was a race I did last year, double-handed, and it's based on the old coffee routes.
Okay.
Like the colonial routes between France and the coffee countries. And this is the route de rum. So it's based on the old rum routes back over to the Caribbean. So it's actually all built in like
Brilliant.
French maritime history and their love of rum.
And how long has this been kind of a goal that you've been working towards?
Well, I'd say like on the big conceptual scheme, like I could say when I was a small kid and the Volvo Ocean Race came to Galway and I imagined being on a high-speed boat crashing through the ocean. That was like it, you know? But then moving through these steps and realising how I could actually formulate that into a real thing. It's been a goal, like a really concrete goal, for 4 years from the last route to Rome. It's once every 4 years. So it's kind of like our Olympics. You get one chance every 4 years to do it. And I was there working for a team at the last one. And I was like this is the ultimate. Like if I imagine I could do that. That would really, like, just, you know,
it's
like
going
like
across the Atlantic.
It's across the Atlantic from Saint-Malo in France to Guadeloupe.
And how long would that kind of typically take? What's a good time?
15 days would be very good.
Wow.
Yeah.
You've crossed the Atlantic 11 times already?
I think it's almost 15 now.
Oh, wow.
Because I did two more there last year.
Just casually.
Yeah. So, and solo on your own. So it is recognized as kind of the toughest solo transatlantic race, because the thing is, you start in Saint-Malo in France, which is northern France. So essentially opposite England. So you're starting in the North Atlantic in November. And I think, like, being from Ireland, we know what that means. That means storms, wind, like carnage, essentially.
Do you drive on regardless? Like, if you can see that there's poor weather systems coming in, are you just avoiding those and like taking the knock to your time? Or is there ever a case where you're like, it's too dangerous, like we can't continue?
Yeah, it's actually a very, very good question. It's a balance. It's a balance between the two. Like, if you're already in there and you're already, like, if you're already racing, say, for instance, you're already in the middle of the sea halfway between, halfway across the Atlantic, hypothetically, and there is a storm evolving, at that point, you know, do you have time to run to land? Not necessarily. So you're always analysing what's coming and what's happening. So with weather models now, like 3 days out, they're very accurate. 5 days out, you have a relative view, but it's not accurate. But we can still see 10 days out what we think is forming meteorologically in the ocean. So we always have we're always looking and we're always watching. So it's rare that we're going to get surprised by a storm. We might get surprised by the ferocity of it because it could be stronger or not. And we might be surprised by the positioning exactly of it, so we can get a little bit caught out. So often we'll be watching that, and we'll have decided at least 3 days ahead how we're planning to attack it. Like, is it okay and we're going to go through it? Are we going to go try and go around it? Do we need to just like batten down the hatches and take it? Or how is it going to go? And there's another side of it that's become more, interestingly, more and more common. And like, it's global warming, but it seems that the storms coming across the North Atlantic are more and more ferocious, more and more frequent, and earlier in the year. So these races that have started this time of year for generations, the last two transatlantic races that I did, we were forced to take a pit. We started the race, it's meant to be non-stop. We were forced by the race organisation to take a pit stop because the storms coming in were so bad that they were not sending them, you know?
What's it like on board a boat for those like 15 days when you've got weather? Like, what does the 24 hours look like?
It changes a lot. It really changes a lot. Like, there's not, you lose a bit of sense of time. Like, there is no night and day, really, except for that your conditions change a little bit. And it really changes a lot depending on, what's going on around you. So you become very just attuned to your world, like your little world on the boat. And again, then the bigger world of the ocean around you. But it's really like, what's going on? So for instance, when you start a race, the first 24 hours, like, no sleep. Minimum 24 hours, maybe 48, because you've just started, so adrenaline is up. There's boats all around you because you've started, so you're close, so that the fleet hasn't spread out, you know. Although often we'll finish a race after the last transatlantic, the time difference in the finish was a number of minutes. So the racing is still very close, but particularly at the start, you can be quite condensed and you start near shore. So also the navigation is complicated. You're near shore, there could be shipping, there should be a lot of ships. So that's a very intense time. So in that case, you'd be napping maximum and you're just kind of on the whole time. Whereas, for instance, later on in a transatlantic, when you're in the middle of the ocean, it's a bit more relaxed. There's less land you're going to hit. There's less boats around. And maybe the weather conditions are more stable. So then you can find, okay, the boat's in a good rhythm. I know nothing dramatic is happening weather-wise in the next few hours. So you can start to get more into rhythm and start to take longer naps. So you have to really change depending on what's going on.
So it's actually more relaxing just being surrounded by open water.
That's better, yeah.
What sounds like would be the most stressful situation is probably the best.
Yeah.
And so that's kicking off in November. And we could sit here and chat all day.
I really want to, yeah.
We will have to wrap it up, but you've secured qualification for this, or is that something that's going to happen over the next couple of months?
Yeah, so we're working on it. There's three things you need to do. So you need an accumulation of miles, because there's only a certain amount of spots in the race. So, and you can't obviously just rock up and do it either. And there's a lot of boats that want to do the race. So then that comes down to miles, and you know, the top 40 boats with the skippers with the biggest amount of miles are eligible for qualification. So I raced a lot last year in order to get those miles. And I'll race a lot this year, but just in case something happens, you know, if I have a problem with the boat or something. But I've already got a lot of miles, so I'm sitting well in that position, so that should be okay. I have to do a qualifying race, solo race, which I'll do in April, which is 1,500 miles, so about 5 days. So I need to finish that. And then you basically need to pay your entry fee.
So we can keep an eye out for you on Instagram. You document a lot of it on Instagram.
Yeah, a lot on Instagram at PammyBeFree. And also, actually, importantly, we're actually coming to Ireland this year in June to race the Around Ireland race. So I'll be bringing the race boat, and we'll be around Dublin and Wicklow and everything and around. So there's actually a really good chance to engage with a little bit there, and I'm bringing some of the other Class 40s over. So
we'll definitely love to chat to you again over the course of the year.
Keep an eye out in the waters, Pamela. Yes. Thank you so much.
Thanks a million, guys.
Thank you.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah?
Yeah. I believe in Mike Hankey, and I suppose they're good at football. They just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12. I love playing 10. I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
No!
Thank you for all the supporters. Thank you for the team. Thank you, France. Merci, la France. Merci, les baguettes. Merci, les croissants. Je vous aime. I love you.